Chapter 77. Devine got Meyer's home address from the company database he had previously hacked into. He lived on Staten Island. They cabbed over, and Devine had the driver drop them off about a block from the house. It was situated in a neighborhood of working-class homes. "He's got a new ride," said Devine, eyeing the silver Ford F-150 pickup truck in the driveway with temporary tags. "Wonder where he got the money for that."
"I doubt he'll volunteer it."
"I can be persuasive." They knocked on the door, but no one answered. They looked in the small backyard. It was empty except for an old pickup truck up on cinder blocks. There was a one-car garage, but the doors were locked. Devine peered in the window, but didn't see anything helpful.
"Maybe he has another car."
"Maybe, but I doubt it. He's not married and he lives alone, the security guard at Cal told me."
"Can I help you?"
They looked around to see a woman standing on the front porch of the house next door. She had on leggings and a long t-shirt. She was in her 20s with a baby riding on one hip. "We were looking for Jerry," said Devine. "We were supposed to meet for a beer, but he didn't show." She gazed over at the house.
"It's funny. He was supposed to help my husband with a project we are doing in the backyard. When he didn't show up this morning, we called and went over there, but it's all locked up. And Jerry didn't answer his phone."
"Does he have another car?"
"No, we bought that new Ford. It's a beauty. A King Ranch model with lots of bells and whistles. My husband Barry says it must have cost around $60,000.
"Wow."
"Yeah. He works at some big muckety-muck company in the city. Jerry said they gave out big bonuses to everybody."
"But if this is his only ride, he must be inside. Do you think he's sick or something?" A large, beefy man came out onto the front porch. The woman said,
"Barry, these people were supposed to meet Jerry for a beer, but no one answered. Now I'm getting worried."
Barry looked over at Myers' house and the truck. He eyed Devine. "Should we call the cops?" "Maybe we should check first. If he's in there sleeping off a bender, the cops will not be happy with us."
"Good point. Jerry likes his beer for sure."
He and Devine went up on Myers' front porch, and Devine studied the door and the glass side panel.
"This is the easiest way."
He put his elbow through the glass, cleared out the shards, reached through, and undid the lock. Barry opened the door and they stepped through.
"Hey, Jer, it's Barry from next door. You okay?"
Barry sucked in a breath and blanched.
"What the hell is that smell?"
Devine knew exactly what it was. "Go call the cops, Barry."
"What?"
"The cops. Call them. We have a situation."
"What situation?"
Devine peered around a corner and into the small kitchen. "A dead body situation. Jerry Myers will never get to enjoy his new pickup truck." 2 hours later, the house was swarming with police and a forensic scrub team. Devine had thought to call Detective Shoemaker. He was off today, but he and Ekman showed up anyway. They met up outside the house. "The dead guy is Jerry Myers, the custodian at Cal who found Sarah Hughes' body," explained Devine while Montgomery leaned against a patrol car. "Looks like somebody killed him." The detectives went into the house and came back out 30 minutes later. Shoemaker said,
"The prelim from the ME is some sort of poison. Frothing on the lips, color of the skin. He was on the kitchen floor. There was an open bottle of whiskey on the counter and some in a glass. We're having it all analyzed."
"What's the TOD?" asked Devine.
"Prelim is about 6:30 last night."
"Did anybody see anything?"
asked Montgomery.
"Not so far." "But why kill the janitor?" asked Ekman.
Devine said, "Because I think Myers killed Sarah Hughes late on Thursday night. Then on Friday morning, he finds the body, which makes him pretty much above suspicion."
"Jesus," exclaimed Shoemaker. "We never thought about that angle."
"I wouldn't have either, except for her," said Devine, motioning to Montgomery. Ekman eyed Montgomery suspiciously.
"And how do you figure into this?"
"I was Brad Cowell's girlfriend."
"Oh, you were, were you?"
Devine said, "She's working with us on this, and we came out here because something Myers told me didn't add up."
"Like what?"
asked Shoemaker. Devine told him Myers said he had gone into the storage closet because someone had requested a printer cartridge. But there was no one on the floor that morning because of a seminar at the Ritz, so there was no one to ask Myers to get anything. I think they knew about the seminar and picked that day because of it. That way there would be no one on the floor who might find the body. Myers also probably wanted a second chance to go over the crime scene to make sure there was nothing incriminating left there. And any forensics of his found there would seem innocent since he went in there and found the body, added Ekman.
Right. Pretty slick plan, said Shoemaker. But why kill Hughes? Were they having an affair? Was he a jealous stalker who wanted to be with Hughes and she rebuffed him? Is it just the old story of a rejected guy?
I might think so, except for that. Devine pointed at the brand new F-150.
That was his payoff.
And the fact that he was poisoned shows he was working with someone and that someone decided to get rid of that loose end, opined Ekman.
That the guy ran out and bought a new truck was probably not a good thing. The person who hired him might have been afraid the cops would take a second look at Myers, and he'd fall apart and start pointing fingers, said Devine.
Shoemaker nodded. We did check on the guy. Always do when it's the person who finds the body. You don't need a security card to get in during regular business hours if you come through the front doors. Now, you need your security card at all times if you come in the rear. He said he came in the front doors at 8 and left at 5 the same way and took the ferry to Staten Island. The guard doesn't remember specifically seeing him that day, but he did confirm that Myers always came and went by the front entrance. We had no reason to suspect him. Myers had no motive or opportunity, at least that's what we thought.
What about the building's security camera showing people coming and leaving?
Inconclusive. We checked the footage for that time, but there was a large group of people leaving around 5, and we couldn't ID everybody, including him.
I can tell you from experience, Detective, that that footage isn't worth the pixels it's built on. Chapter 78. Devine and Montgomery took their leave from the detectives and Staten Island. As they cabbed it back to Manhattan, Montgomery said,
So, Myers killed 4 people in exchange for a new pickup truck?
He glanced at her. I've seen people do it for a lot less than that, Michelle. They rode the rest of the way in silence. Devine took the train back out to his house after dropping off Montgomery at her hotel and walked home from there. Valentine wasn't on the couch or in the kitchen filling his belly. Overhead, Devine could hear Tapshaw tap-tapping away on her computer, happy as a clam. Helen Spears stood in her doorway and stared at him as he came up the stairs.
Busy day?
Another dead body found.
Who was it this time?
You're not surprised?
What's one more?
He stood in front of her and shook his head. I really don't get you.
You don't have to, just like I don't have to get you. Where's your friend Michelle?
In a safe place. So you like the Glock over the Sig?
And you like the Sig Sauer over the Glock, good army man that you are. But diversity makes the world go round. I'm living proof of that.
She closed the door. He knocked on Valentine's door, but there was no answer. He tried the knob. It turned and he poked his head in.
Will, you in here eating pizza under the bed covers?
But Valentine wasn't there. He'd never been in Valentine's room before. What was astonishing to him was how neat and clean it was. Bed made, desk tidy, monster computer screens that rivaled Tapshaw's. Some books in Russian were on a shelf, shoes lined up against one wall. He looked in the closet and saw that the clothes were neatly hung and separated by pants and shirts. His dresser was just as organized. He had gotten adept at doing searches like this back in the army. Out on patrols, they would frequently have to work their way through the homes of suspected Taliban and Al-Qaeda allies and informants. And those guys really knew how to hide stuff, he had discovered. He looked over the desk and saw some post-it notes affixed to the screen. They were all in Cyrillic. He smiled. Nice little piece of security there. In one desk drawer were some framed photos. They looked to be about 20 years old or so, judging by the clothes the people wore. A man and a woman were holding a baby with a girl around 6 next to them. Maybe that was Valentine's family back in Mother Russia. He might be the baby boy. He heard a noise downstairs. Devine put the photo back, closed the door, and left the room. He knocked on Tapshaw's door just as Valentine came up the stairs. His expression was serious, focused, Devine thought, until he saw Divine. Then Valentine smiled and said,
Dude.
Yeah, dude. Hey, Will, how goes it? Tapshaw opened her door in her fluffy bunny slippers and capri pants with a white top.
Hey, guys, is this a party or what?
Spears opened her door and looked out. She eyed everyone and said,
All we do is pass each other every day and night. How about we go out for some beer and chips, roomies, and actually get to know each other?
They crammed into Tapshaw's Mini Cooper and made the short drive to downtown Mount Kisco. The pub was rocking, but they found an empty table outside and ordered their beers and food. Valentine also had a vodka tonic and a slice of meatball pizza. Tapshaw took a sip of her beer and said,
I think the Taiwanese are going to invest. Not the full amount I was initially looking for, but at least half.
That's great, Jill. He didn't know if she had heard about Chilton's murder, and he was not going to bring it up. Spears looked at her and said,
How did you get into the online dating space? I know your background because I Googled you. You could be working for NASA or NSA.
I got offers from both while I was at MIT, but while NASA does many wonderful things, I'd rather focus on this planet. And the NSA? I don't want to spy on people. I want to help them be happy.
Valentine finished his vodka tonic in one impressive gulp.
But people can be happy alone. I am example of this. I do not need nobody to be, as you say, happy. I am happy with me.
Come on, Will. Everyone needs somebody.
Divine eyed him. How'd you end up in Mount Kisco doing what you do?
I can do what I do from anywhere. This is nice place. I move around a lot before, but this is nice place. I stay here.
Where were you before?
In big city of New York. But I did not like it. Too many people. Remind me of Moscow. Only in Moscow people either stay home or go to bar. They do not, how you say, wander around. You wander around there, you get shot or arrested.
Well, I like it here too, but I also like to travel. I did that to learn about what people wanted from each other. That helped me put my platform together. Other sites ask you all these questions to build a profile so they can match you with a person of like interests. And we do some of that too. But what about the old saying, opposites attract? A great relationship doesn't mean that the people are carbon copies of each other. Then it's like you're staring in a mirror every day. What about two very different people getting together and learning from each other? Changing what they like and dislike because they have someone who lets them see another slice of life.
Me? I want another slice of pizza. Then I am happy man.
Tapshaw tittered at this, but Divine didn't join in. Spears had eyed Valentine in a way that Divine didn't like. A thought suddenly hit him. Did these two know each other before? But if they did, why was she searching his room? Then he thought about the picture in Valentine's room and the girl. Hey, Will, do you have a family back in Russia? Brother, sister? Valentine finished his beer before answering.
I have nobody, dude. Nobody. Way I like it.
Chapter 79. It was nearly 4 a.m. when Divine rolled over in his bed and coughed. Then he coughed again, harder. The next moment, he couldn't catch his breath. In his murky mind, he thought, Am I having a heart attack? He sat up in bed and his head felt like it was underwater. What the hell was going on? He'd had 2 beers, not 10. Then he inhaled, and the smell answered all his questions. Shit. He jumped up out of bed and almost crashed against the wall. He ripped open the door and gagged. He pulled his t-shirt up over his nose and mouth, went down to his knees, and scuttled across the hall to Spears' room. He tried the knob. It was locked. He rose and put his shoulder to it. It flew open, and he saw Spears in the bed. She didn't react to his crashing into her room, which was not a good sign. He stumbled over and tried to wake her. He checked her pulse. Still there, barely. He lifted her up and carried her down the stairs and out the front door. He set her down in the grass and ran back in. He checked Tapshaw's room next. Her door was not locked. She was unconscious on the floor. He confirmed that she was still breathing and carried her outside and set her next to Spears. He ran back inside and knocked open Valentine's locked door. He wasn't in there. Devine looked wildly around and even checked under the bed, in the closet, and also the bathroom. The man wasn't there. After grabbing his phone, he ran back outside and called 911 and then the gas company's emergency number. There was a garden hose next to the front door. He turned it on and sprinkled water over the women. Then he patted their faces, turned them on their sides, and applied pressure to their backs to help their lungs expand. Their breath started getting deeper, and their color finally started returning. Spears even managed to sit up. She looked at Devine.
What is...
Gas in the house. You're okay now. I called the ambulance, but I can't find Will. She plopped back down in the grass and threw up. Tapshaw briefly came to, and Devine told her the same thing. Then he turned and ran back into the house. He threw open windows everywhere and also the back door. He searched every inch of the space for Valentine, but the Russian was not there. A minute later, two ambulances pulled up. The EMTs jumped out and administered oxygen to both the women and Devine, too. They ran fluids into the women as well, but Devine declined, telling them that he was fine.
What about the townhouses on either side of you? Said one of the EMTs. The gas might have seeped into them, too, or originated from there.
They're both empty, said Devine. After triaging the ladies, the EMTs decided to take them both to the hospital. The ambulances pulled out about the time the gas company showed up. Two men quickly climbed out of the truck, and Devine told them what had happened. 30 minutes later, they came back out of the house.
Somebody did it on purpose, said one of the men. Fiddled with the line going into your townhouse and then opened up the pilot on the fireplace in the living room. We got safety features for that now, but this is an old house and nobody upgraded it.
I told the EMTs the homes next door were empty, but they're being renovated and guys might be showing up to work there today. Some of the gas might have gone in there.
We'll put up signs for them to stay out. Then we'll contact the owner and get the places checked and cleared out if need be.
Okay, thanks.
Lucky escape for you, said the other man. You sure you're okay?
I'm fine. Is it safe to go in now?
Yeah, it's all aired out, but don't turn on any electrical switches for a while just to be sure. I'll have a crew out here in an hour to check everything 7 ways from Sunday.
Thanks.
You got any enemies, buddy? Asked the other man.
Devine looked at him.
Well, I got at least one.
Another team from the gas company showed up later and gave the house a thorough going over. They also checked the homes next door after getting in touch with the owner. There was no evidence of gas in either of them. Devine went back into the house after calling the hospital and checking on Spears and Tapshaw. They were both in the ER and being monitored. Their oxygen levels were still low, and the doctors had decided to keep them in the hospital until they were completely out of danger. Devine looked around the house once more and found no sign of Valentine. Devine had called and texted him but gotten no reply. He went up to the man's room and found that his bed had not been slept in. They had gotten home around 11 last night, and Devine had fallen asleep pretty much right away. Obviously, Spears and Tapshaw had too. Nor was Valentine's laptop or phone anywhere to be found. But a suitcase he had spotted in the closet when he had previously searched Valentine's room was gone, along with what looked to be some clothes. He went into Tapshaw's room and looked around. Then his gaze froze on her computer screen. Taped to it was a diagram on a piece of paper. He sat down and read quickly through it. It started off with the oddly numbered email sender addresses that he had given Tapshaw to track down. In a flowsheet structure, it went from that line of numbers to a dozen different configurations, which he supposed were the electronic subterfuges the sender had used to disguise their identity and also to send an email without the requisite internet protocols. When he got to the end of the flow, he gaped. There was an email address that he seemed to recognize, and under it, in parenthesis, was written a name. Will Valentine. And next to that, holy shit. Devine went back down to the living room and stared at the gas fireplace. There were no signs of forced entry. Whoever had manipulated the gas here had been inside the house last night. Clearly, suspicion fell on the man who had not almost died from carbon monoxide poisoning, and who was now AWOL. Now things started to fall into place for Devine. Valentine was Russian. He had come to the townhouse about the same time Devine had, A good portion of the money pouring through Cal and Cumley had been identified by Campbell's people as coming from Russia and countries friendly to it. Valentine was a genius with computers, so it would have been easy for him to put together a very difficult email to trace. Ironic that I asked him to track an email he'd sent. The guy must have laughed his ass off about that one. I was filling him in on an investigation in which he was already a part, only on the opposite side, and he would tell me nothing about Area 51. Of course he wouldn't. How could he have been so blind? Valentine also knew about Divine and Sarah Yu's dating, the only roommate of Divine's who had before Yu's had been killed. That means that the motive for killing them had nothing to do with me. That was just misdirection. It had everything to do with what Sarah found out about the Locust Group, and then she told Jennifer Stamos, and Stamos had come here. Valentine had let her in. He might have eavesdropped on their conversation on the front porch, and so Stamos had to die too. And the Hugheses were in their daughter's house. Valentine and company couldn't take the chance that they might find additional evidence their daughter had left behind. Just like I thought before. Always go with your gut. The symbolic murders that Divine had theorized about were all bullshit distractions. This was all about two things, money and power. But in reality, they were one and the same. Divine left the house and went to the hospital. Chapter 80. Tapshaw looked weak and shaky. Her eyes fluttered open and then closed. Divine studied her vitals on the monitor and noted that her oxygen levels were improved, but not nearly back to normal. She was very thin and probably didn't have a lot of robust reserve to overcome this easily. He sat next to her bed and held her hand and watched her slight chest rise and fall. "I'm so sorry this happened, Jill," he said. First she had lost the investment from Chilton and Mayflower Enterprises, and now she'd almost died. And it was probably all connected to what Divine was looking into, with Will Valentine as the unknown factor.
"Is... okay, Travis.
I saw your information on the email, Jill. I saw that you traced it to Will."
Will... email...
It now occurred to Divine that that was the reason Valentine had made a run for it and tried to kill them all. He had somehow discovered that Tapshaw had found him out. "I'll follow up on that, Jill. Don't worry about that. We'll find him, I promise. But I think I should contact your family. I know your mom lives in California, but what about your dad and your brother Dennis? Do you have contact info for them on your phone or in your room?" He knew he couldn't get on her phone or laptop without her passwords. She mumbled something incoherent and then fell back asleep. He glanced at her monitor, where everything seemed to be holding its own but didn't seem to be improving. He wished her color looked better. He left her there and ventured to Helen Spears's room. Only she wasn't there.
"She checked herself out AMA about 2 hours ago,"
the nurse told Divine when he made inquiries. "Against medical advice?"
"Yes, but I think she'll be fine. She was already recovering nicely when she was brought in. She's a very fit young woman. The other woman is a lot frailer, and she's also anemic. We're watching her closely."
"Did Spears say where she might be going? We roomed together."
"She didn't."
He wondered if Spears and Valentine had met up, and if they had, why? "I might have enemies on both flanks right in my own camp." He went to work the next day and sat beside burners who were openly weeping in front of their computer screens. Word had obviously gotten around that the firm was going under. He had contacted Caltech because he remembered that was where Tapshaw's mother taught and left a message for her explaining a little of what had happened. He had heard nothing from Spears. He then received a text from Montgomery and they arranged to meet later in the city. When he got to the cafe in Tribeca, she was already waiting. He filled her in on what had happened at his townhouse.
"Oh my God.
So two of my roomies are now missing, and Valentine wasn't there when the gas got turned on."
"Was he working with the laundering operation? With Cowell?"
"I think so." He went on to explain that Valentine had been the one to send him the emails.
"Well, then he must be working with them."
"And he tried to get rid of me, and my other roommates were collateral damage. But Jill tracked him down online, and Campbell's men have an APB out on him."
"And Spears?"
Divine shook his head. "She checked herself out of the hospital. She hasn't answered my texts or emails or phone calls.
That is so odd.
She reached out and took his hand.
Look, the stuff Brad was talking about. With you and the other soldiers in the army?
What about it?
Is that why you left the military?
Yes. It ended with both of them dead, and I have a level of guilt from all of it that will haunt me until my dying day. She sat back and studied him.
Whatever happened there, I believe that you did what you thought was the right thing. The honorable thing.
Why do you believe that?
Because, despite your best efforts to make yourself out to be a shit, you're actually a really good guy. A really nice guy, Travis. I can tell. Trust me. I've seen the whole spectrum of men, and you're definitely one of the good ones.
He took her hand and squeezed it, and she leaned over and kissed him.
Now what will you do?
The mission's not finished yet.
I mean after that.
Not sure. Keep working for Campbell. I don't think I have a choice, really.
Do you want company?
I'm not sure Campbell would go for that. No, I am sure he wouldn't.
I meant on the personal side.
You can do a hell of a lot better than me, Michelle. While I hope I am a nice, honorable guy, I'm also a washed-up soldier with daddy problems. She gazed at him.
You're a West Point grad. Army officer. You defended this country in combat. You have an MBA. I have a high school diploma and look great in a bikini, and I have serious mommy problems. I think you can do a hell of a lot better than me. But we could make it, if we worked at it.
What I need to work at is finding out who killed all those people. She sighed and sat forward.
But I thought Jerry Myers did it.
I think he killed Sarah, but I'm not sure about the others.
Do you really think it could be your missing roommate?
Which one, Valentine or Spears?
Could they be working together?
Devine thought back to the night at the bar where Spears and Valentine just seemed to have an odd connection. But then she had searched his room, and he had left Spears for dead. I don't know. I really don't.
Have the police found out anything more on Jerry Myers?
Detective Shoemaker contacted me. The killer spiked the bottle of whiskey with enough cyanide to kill an elephant.
Wow, taking no chances. But if you think Myers was paid to kill Sarah Hughes, why wouldn't the person who killed him have gotten him to kill all the others, too? I know you have your gut feeling on this, but Myers could have killed everybody.
Sarah, I think, had to be hanged, at least in the killer's deranged mind. Sarah was about 5'9 and athletically built. Not so easy to hoist someone like that up on a rope. And then the person had to strangle her first. Myers was my size, big and strong, and he had access to the building. The others? Stamos was drugged and then killed. A knife was used on the Hugheses, too. Anyone could have done that, including a woman.
A woman? But now I thought you said Valentine was behind this. Although I guess it could be Helen Spears who killed Jennifer Stamos and the Hugheses.
He looked at her inscrutably, certain thoughts, uncomfortable thoughts, running through his mind. I don't think Will would know which end of a knife to stab someone with. And with his big gut, he's not crawling through windows. He can barely walk up the stairs. And if he was working with the people behind the money laundering, they'd have plenty of skilled foot soldiers to do the deeds, but...
But what?
Why pay off Myers to kill Sarah? Again, why not just use one of your own people, like Hancock?
Well, Myers had access to the building, like you said.
So did Brad Cowell, retorted Devine. He fell silent. At first he had thought Cowell had been behind the killings. Then he had changed his mind and thought there was a different killer who had had a grudge against him and who had sent him the weird emails and killed his victim symbolically. Then he'd changed his opinion again and decided it was the people behind Cowell and now Valentine who had done the killings, or at least he was involved, and all the rest was just misdirection. But now I'm not sure. Again. There was something off here, really off, and he just couldn't figure out what it was. But I have to, eventually, or else a killer walks free to kill me. Chapter 81. That night, Devine went back to an empty townhouse. Spears's room held her unused law books, but not the Glock under the mattress. The woman had evidently left the hospital, come back here, and gotten her weapon. He wondered why, and he also wondered where she was now. They had all returned from the bar and gone to their rooms. At around 4 a.m., Devine had been awoken by the gas. During that time, Valentine must have messed with the gas lines and fled, leaving them all to die. Campbell had texted him that their APB had so far turned up no leads on the man. Where the hell are you, Will? Back in Moscow getting a medal from Putin? He was about to go up to his room when the phone rang. He didn't recognize the number, but decided to answer it. Hello?
Mr. Devine?
Yes, who's this?
Emily Spanner.
I'm afraid I don't...
I'm Jill Tapshaw's mother.
Oh, Mrs. Spanner, I'm sorry. I looked up the faculty at Caltech, but didn't see a Tapshaw listed, so I just left a message on the department receptionist voicemail for Professor Tapshaw.
It's all right. Spanner is my maiden name. That's happened before, and I finally got your message. But what has happened? Is Jill okay?
She's fine. There was a gas leak in our townhouse. I'm one of her roommates. But we all got out okay. They took Jill to the hospital for observation, but the last time I checked, she was fine.
Oh my God, I had no idea. You're sure she's in no danger?
Devine wasn't quite sure how to answer that, since it was clear someone had tried to kill them. Or maybe just me. But he didn't want to unduly worry the woman. No, she's fine, really.
Do you think I should come out there?
From a health perspective, I don't think it's necessary, but I'm sure she'd love to see you.
I'm not too sure about that.
I don't understand.
It's just family issues, Mr. Devine. We're all dysfunctional in our own way.
Devine thought of his own family. Truer words were never spoken. I didn't have any contact info on Jill's father, or even his first name.
George is in Canada. We're divorced.
And I couldn't find any contact information for your son.
Dennis.
Yes, I thought Jill's twin might want to know about what happened to her, too.
I'm sure he would have.
Would have.
Dennis is dead. He passed away nearly 9 months ago.
Oh my God, I had no idea. Jill never mentioned that.
Does Jill have her phone with her in the hospital? Can I call her?
No, but I can get it and take it to her.
That would be very nice, thank you. And thank you for contacting me.
Jill is a really wonderful person. She works really hard.
Yes, Hummingbird has been her dream for a while now.
It's been very successful.
She could be working anywhere, you know, with her skills and mind. She could be teaching at UPenn or Stanford.
But this makes her happy, bringing people together.
Yes, I suppose it does. Well, thank you again for letting me know.
Sure, thanks for the call back. And I'll get Jill's phone to her.
I appreciate that. Goodbye.
Devine put his phone back in his pocket. Why hadn't Tapshaw mentioned that her twin was dead? But then again, he hadn't really talked to his roommates about his family. Still, he wondered how Dennis Tapshaw had died. He climbed the stairs to Tapshaw's room and went inside. A search of her things revealed no phone. He wondered if she had left it at work. He'd noticed that she hadn't had it with her at the bar. He looked around and saw a set of keys on a brown file folder. He picked them up and saw her car key on there. There was another key on there, too, but he knew it wasn't to the office. She used an electronic security card to get into her space like they did at Cowell and Cumley. He knew that because she had taken him for a tour once and had used her security card to get in. He had a sudden thought and went down to the garage and unlocked her Mini Cooper. He searched through it and found the RFID card in the console. This should get him into the office okay. He decided he might as well drive her car the short distance to the office rather than firing up his motorcycle. He also searched the car to make sure she hadn't left the phone in there, but he didn't find it. He called the phone to see if it had perhaps slipped down between the seat and the console, but he heard no ringing or vibrating. There were some stains on the front seat that he wiped away with his hand. Tapshaw was not the cleanest or most organized person in the world. When they had ridden over to the bar in her car, he had been in the back seat with Valentine. His feet had been resting on top of mountains of old fast food containers and used Starbucks coffee cups. and her car's interior smelled like a dumpster. He drove over to the strip of shops where Hummingbird was headquartered. The RFID card did its magic, and the door unlocked. He went inside and flicked on the lights. Since Tapshaw had given him a tour through the office, he knew the layout. There was a large open work area with a dozen computer screens flashing the Hummingbird homepage, smart boards on the walls, desks and iPads and stacks of papers and marketing materials and files, copy machines, a water dispenser, a small kitchen and bathroom, and everything else one would normally see in an office. He knew the cloud that ran the Hummingbird platform was housed elsewhere because Tapshaw had told him. Tapshaw's office was in the back corner. He tried the door, but it was locked. Then he saw the reader port and waved the RFID card in front of it, and the door clicked open. He turned on the light and looked around at the messy space. He again had the idea of calling her phone to see if it would ring somewhere in the mounds of all the stuff in here, but it didn't. She might have it on silent, but he didn't hear vibrating anywhere either. The battery might have died for all he knew. He started to slowly search the space. The woman's workload was immense, if all the docs he was looking at were an indicator. It was no wonder she looked tired all the time. He looked through all the file cabinets until he came to one that was locked. He hesitated, and then decided to see if the other key on the ring would open it. He didn't know why she would lock her phone up in there, but he had seen her rushing around enough times trying to find stuff at the townhouse. Her car keys had once ended up in the refrigerator for some odd reason. The key worked, and he slid the drawer open. There was a mass of papers in here and some colored files. He moved them out of the way to see if perhaps the phone had slipped down to the bottom when he saw the red file. He slowly pulled it out. It was from the doctor's office of Jonathan Wyman, more specifically, his clinic for women wanting to undergo artificial insemination. A stunned Divine slowly opened it and started to read what was inside. The patient's name was Sarah Elise Hughes. The procedure was artificial insemination using donor sperm. Then, written on a post-it note, was a name. Sperm donor, Dennis Tapshaw. Jill's twin brother was the sperm donor for Sarah Hughes' pregnancy. Divine was so overwhelmed by these revelations that he could barely think. He turned when he heard the noise behind him. Jill Tapshaw was standing in the doorway, pointing Divine's SIG at its owner. Chapter 82.
What are you doing here, Travis?
He let the file drop to the desk. Looking for your phone, your mother called. She wanted to reach you. I knew you didn't have your phone with you at the hospital. I was trying to find it. It wasn't... She held up her hand.
Just stop, okay? Please, just stop. Who cares about a phone or my mother?
She glanced down at what he had been holding.
Wonderful Dr. Wyman.
Who?
Don't pull this stupid act, okay? I'm really tired from sucking in all that gas.
Okay, then let's talk about this, but not with the gun pointed at me.
I told you to drop the stupid act. The gun is going nowhere.
She seemed like a totally different person now. He also had the impression that perhaps the Jill Tapshaw he thought he knew was an act. Maybe this was the real version. He picked up the file. You and Sarah were having a baby together?
That was the plan. Didn't end well. But you know that, right?
And your brother was the sperm donor?
Why not? He was perfect.
I also understand that he's dead. By the look on her face, Divine wished he hadn't mentioned that.
Who told you he was dead?
Your mother. I mentioned that I wanted to let him know about your being in the hospital, and that's when she told me he died. He paused. Only she didn't tell me how he died. Tapshaw held up the gun.
He put one of these in his mouth and pulled the fucking trigger.
Why would he do that? You said he had everything going for him.
Because Dennis desperately wanted to transition to being a woman, and my brilliant father couldn't accept that. That's why my parents finally divorced. He was awful to Dennis. Never 1 minute's peace, never any support. He drove him to suicide. I wanted to kill him, but he ran away to Canada and nobody knows where he is.
Wyman said he didn't know who the sperm donor was.
He didn't. Neither did Sarah at first.
So you and Sarah were in love and were having a baby? Why didn't anyone know about that?
You met her parents. So do you really have to ask the question? Sarah wasn't about to tell them about me. It's not like my father would have been thrilled with two, as he would see it, alien children.
But no one even knew you and Sarah were dating? That's hard to believe.
Sarah wanted it that way. She wanted to move up in her field.
There are lots of gay people in the world of finance.
Not that many gay women.
She bit her lip and looked unsure for a moment.
And Sarah was confused, it seemed to me, about her sexuality.
Tapshaw's face twisted angrily.
She needed to make up her mind. So we kept things quiet. Very quiet.
So you two broke up. And she terminated the pregnancy. Why? She motioned with the gun to the file drawer that Divine had been looking through.
Her diary is in there, in a yellow folder. Read it for yourself.
Divine slowly pulled the folder out and found a black journal inside. He flipped through the pages.
The entry for December 4th.
Divine found it and read through Yuz's notes. He finished and looked up. She was afraid of you? She was afraid you were unbalanced? That you were obsessed with your brother?
He had recently killed himself. I was distraught.
She wrote that you had a shrine to him in your room? That you were too emotional, too over the top, too controlling, and that this was before he killed himself? In her diary, she wrote that after that, you really lost it.
She had no reason to be afraid of me. I loved her. And so what if I idolized my brother? Is that a crime?
You said she didn't know he was the sperm donor until later?
She found out. I don't know how. I was supposed to be anonymous, but I arranged for Dennis to donate the sperm.
Is that why she terminated the pregnancy? She didn't want to carry your brother's baby?
It wasn't his baby. It was my baby. We were twins. If we were the same gender, we'd have the same fucking DNA. Dennis got the Y chromosome, but he didn't want it. And she killed my baby. She might as well have put a bullet in my mouth.
And when you found out, you decided to kill her?
No, I didn't. I was still dealing with Dennis's death.
Her face twisted in anger at him.
But then I found out you two were seeing each other. She moved to her new place. But I found out. I saw you there with her. I know you slept with her. When a room became available at the townhouse where you lived, I grabbed it.
Why?
I needed to watch you. I needed to know if you were going to be a good match for Sarah.
Match? Did you meet her through Hummingbird? She was one of your earliest subscribers, you said. Tapshaw nodded and moved closer to Divine.
We were perfectly aligned in every way. The algorithm said we would be happy forever. It was love at first sight, the way it sometimes happens.
She moved closer.
But then she abandoned me, terminated our child and hooked up with you. And then she dumped you. I didn't know who she was seeing for a while. I thought it must be another man. I could understand and accept that she might like men and not women. I could have lived with that. I really could have. But then I saw her one night with a woman. They were kissing. They were very close. They were in love, obviously.
Jennifer Stamos.
I didn't know her name until I overheard you talking to her outside the townhouse.
Shit, thought Divine. Her room overlooks the front of the house. She heard everything. And that conversation signed Stamos's death warrant. The night she died, you were up early. You said you had a Zoom interview with a magazine in the Netherlands.
There was no interview, but I had just gotten back from killing her, and you caught me, so I had to come up with something.
You didn't have any blood on you or anything.
I wore scrubs over my clothes and booties on my feet, and then got rid of them in a dumpster.
You mutilated her body, Jill.
She took Sarah from me, so I had to take something from her.
You were also probably worried that Sarah had told Stamos about you. But I never mentioned you to Sarah or Jen. There would have been no reason to. But you couldn't chance that. Jen was smart. She might put two and two together, and I got the emails telling me of their deaths. That was you, right? The untraceable emails?
I wanted you to know. I wanted you to feel guilt that you helped cause Sarah's death, and the others too. And making those emails work the way I did was a challenge. I enjoyed it. These internet assholes think they control everything. Well, I just blew that up, didn't I? A little old girl.
And you went out the night that the Uses were killed. You stabbed them in the heart.
Yes. Well, you were probably screwing Spears. I know you two were lusting after each other.
Do you have any idea where she is? Did you kill her, too?
I had no reason to kill her.
But you hired Jerry Myers to kill Sarah. How did you and Myers hook up?
He was Hummingbird subscriber 7904. Lonely man with several bad relationships and one lousy marriage behind him, looking for warmth, humor, and female companionship. New York Giants and New York Mets fans and beer drinkers particularly welcome,
she said, apparently reciting his profile from memory. But how did you get him to do it?
He had been to prison. I found that out. It wasn't in his profile. He did it because I paid him and paid him well. He was just that sort of guy.
But then he bought the truck.
It wasn't just that. He came back to me for more money. I paid him. He came back again for more. He left me no other choice. I don't like people who break their word.
How did he get Sarah alone?
I sent an email to Sarah that she thought was from Brad Cowell, basically ordering her to pull an all-nighter to meet a deadline. I later deleted it completely, and I mean completely. I know how. The NSA desperately wanted me to work for them, and I did for a year, which I never told anyone about. The NSA usually signs you to 5-year deals. They don't like turnover for obvious reasons. But what were they going to do to me? They could keep me from getting another government job, but I didn't want that. So they had no leverage. But the bottom line is that I know how to wipe things clean. Jerry had never left the building. He hid in the storage closet where Sarah was found. He waited until very late to make sure no one was around, went to her office, strangled her, and then strung her up.
Hanged her for what? Being a traitor? To you?
To me and our baby. I had earlier hacked into the firm's calendar and found out about the M&A seminar the next day. That made it perfect for Jerry to kill her the night before. I told him no one would suspect him if he was the one to find the body. And you don't need your card to enter or leave the building during normal business hours. And Jerry had ridden up on the elevator to the 52nd floor with some other people he knew worked on that floor, so he didn't have to use his card. After he killed Sarah, he slept in his spare office and showed up for work in his uniform.
But he would need his security card to take the elevator down from the 52nd.
No, he just used the stairs. There are so many people coming in during the morning that there was no way to say for sure he wasn't in one of those groups. And while he was doing some work in the lobby the day before, Jerry shifted the camera positions just a bit to make it pretty much impossible to verify who came and went through each day. And the guard isn't there every minute. Then Jerry took the elevator up using his card the next morning and started his duties on the 52nd floor.
To find Sarah?
That's right.
Even more reason to have cameras on all the floors and the stairwells, not just the front and rear entrances. She smiled.
From what I heard about Brad Cowell from Jerry, I don't think he would have liked cameras everywhere.
And my security card being on the log the night Sarah died, and my video.
I cloned your card while you were at the high school working out. It was easy.
It's a 125 piece of shit, said Divine dully.
Yes, it is.
In the video?
I took a film editing class in college. I had started thinking about doing something online, and I thought that skill would come in handy. And it did, because I use it on Hummingbird. I took photos and video of you coming and going from the townhouse, Travis. And Jerry was your height and build. I took video of him going in and out of your building. Then I just digitally sliced and diced and put the appropriate clothes on you. Your head on his body. From a distance, it was close enough for the cops to nail you on it.
And Stamos?
After I found out who she was, I got her address, broke into her place, drugged her, and did what I went there to do.
Like carve bitch into her skin?
That was exactly what she was.
No, she was the woman that Sarah loved, and you couldn't live with that. And I was the one who told you about Fred and Ellen Hughes and her attitude towards Sarah. So in a way, I'm the reason they were killed. Stabbed through the heart because they, at least in your mind, had no hearts. Or at least you implied that in your email to me. And then you manipulated the entry logs to show my car going in at the requisite time to kill Sarah. And then you added a video image of me too, like you just said. Only that didn't jibe with what the night security guard saw. I guess you didn't know when the guard made his rounds. And Jerry isn't there at night, so he wouldn't know either. That one little oversight blew up your plan. Her face crinkled, and she gave him a weak smile that showed a bit of the innocent, kind-hearted woman he thought he knew.
You're a smart person, Travis. And I do like you. I really do. You've always been so nice to me. You remind me a little of Dennis, actually.
She stared off for a moment, and her look hardened once more.
But when I found out that witch had killed our baby, and was now with another woman, well, I had to do something.
But why send me the emails? Why set me up to take the fall, Jill?
You were the perfect choice, Travis. I did all the analysis. You're an army ranger, so you know how to kill people. You slept with Sarah. You wanted a relationship with her, and she rejected you. No one could really be certain you weren't the father. Those are motives to kill. I tried to be very logical in choosing you. But the main thing was you loved the woman I loved. In a way, you took her away from me.
I didn't even know you two were seeing each other.
It doesn't matter, okay?
She aimed the gun more rigidly at him. She glanced over at the large computer where the Hummingbird logo was prominently displayed.
Now, Hummingbird is my baby.
Yeah, I remember you saying that to me. The only baby left to you.
I liked Will, too. It was a shame.
What do you mean? He said sharply. In the face of all this, he had forgotten all about Valentine.
When we got back from the bar, he came to my room later. He was really good at hacking. Better than I thought he was.
Understanding filtered through Divine's expression. He finally traced the emails I got, and he traced them back to you. I found the information taped to your computer screen where you showed it was Will who sent them. But that was obviously all a lie.
He was good, despite being a pig. And I hated the way he always used the word dude. I mean, it was like a bad 1980s movie or something.
And when Will found out it was you?
He wanted an explanation. I told him I would give him one. At my office, where I told him I had documents that would explain all. I think I convinced him that you had killed those people and were trying to use both of us to cover up your crimes.
You told him I had asked you to track the emails as well.
I did. And I intimated that you were working with people that could set us both up as being involved in all this. He wasn't a U.S. citizen yet, so he was terrified of being deported. Before we left, I did as much as I could on the computer to turn the tables on him and show he was the source of the emails and not me. I taped up that piece of paper on my computer for people to find.
And then what happened?
On the drive over, I asked him to get something out of the glove box. While he was doing that, I injected him in the neck with the same sedative I used on Stamos. I drove him to the lake near the townhouse. I stabbed him in the chest and tied a heavy rock to him. Then I threw his laptop and phone in the lake too, after I rolled him into the water. Will was very heavy, but I was very determined. When I was throwing his stuff in, my phone fell out of my pocket and went into the water. I had some blood on me from stabbing him. I cleaned it up as best I could, but I probably missed some.
Divine glanced down at his hand where he had rubbed off the stains from her car seat. Will's blood? And the gas in the house, that was you?
I had to come up with a reason for Will's disappearance, namely that he tried to kill all of us and then disappeared. I went back to the townhouse, packed some clothes in his suitcase, and tossed it in a dumpster in the downtown area. Then I came back and fiddled with the gas.
But weren't you afraid of dying from the gas? I mean, you were really close to it, Jill, when I carried you out of the house. She looked at him calmly, with an utterly uninterested expression, which, under the tense standoff, was terrifying.
You should have just let me die, Travis. It would have been much better for me, and certainly much better for you.
Meaning, now it's my turn? Is this what Dennis would have wanted?
Dennis never had a chance to know what he really wanted. But for what it's worth, I'm very sorry, Travis.
She fired the gun, and the bullet slammed into his right shoulder. He fell back against the file cabinet and then dropped to the floor. The blood spurted down his front, and he desperately tried to use his shirt to stanch the bleeding. She moved closer and aimed the gun at his head for the kill shot.
I'm sorry. I meant to shoot you in the chest. I don't have really good aim. But it won't hurt any more in a second, Travis. I promise. I never wanted any of this to happen.
A second shot rang out. Devine watched Tapshaw stiffen as a bullet went into her back, traversed her thin torso, and exited out her chest. In his wounded, muddled state, Devine thought he could see the bullet in midair. The round smacked into the wall and stayed there. Tapshaw swayed on her feet for a moment. Then the SIG fell from her hand, and she followed along with it, hitting the hard floor face first and not moving again, except for one last involuntary twitch as life quickly transitioned to death. A bleeding and rapidly weakening Devine swiveled his head to the doorway. Helen Spears stood there with her Glock still pointing at where Tapshaw had been standing a moment before. She looked down at Devine and started to run toward him, her phone coming out as she tapped in 911.
Travis!
She cried out, right as Devine's eyes closed. Chapter 83. Devine lay in a hospital bed, but his mind was elsewhere. The thump-thump beats of the chopper blades, the swirl of heated desert air, the taste of red sand in his mouth, along with the biting fumes of aviation fuel in his bloody nostrils. None of those things should happen while you're dying, because dying was enough of a bitch. Ass over elbows, the IED had taken Devine, a 225-pound man, loaded down with 50 more pounds of gear, and launched him like a human cannonball across a rut-filled road 50 clicks outside of Kandahar. He hit the dirt unconscious. He woke up to a morphine-inspired fog. He endured multiple surgeries and a skin graft and did it all over again 2 years later when a badly aimed sniper round went through a defect in his body armor and ripped his shoulder apart instead of his brain. Only this time it was the other shoulder, and he was nowhere near Kandahar. Devine blinked himself awake and stared around the antiseptic confines of his hospital room. Just beneath the intoxicating shimmer of the morphine drip, he felt both the snake-like bite of the Sig Sauer 9mm round and the surgery that had followed. Without painkillers, he knew he would be shrieking in agony right now. He flitted across time and space, and then his gaze lingered and stopped on twin figures. Emerson Campbell was in a suit, but without a tie. Helen Spears was in a dark blue jacket and skirt with a red scarf around her neck. For a moment, the drugged-up Devine thought she was an airline flight attendant.
How is consciousness treating you, Devine? Asked Campbell.
Devine tried to form the words, but his mouth, along with his brain, was not entirely under his command. Spears sat down next to him and took his hand, squeezing it in a firm grip.
I'm sorry. I should have been there sooner. I'm so sorry.
And she did look sorry, Devine had to admit. Very sorry indeed. He thought he saw tears bubbling at the edges of those beautiful eyes, but perhaps that was the morphine talking.
Who are...
That was all he could accomplish. Campbell stepped forward.
She's with us, Devine. Special Agent Helen Spears. She fired the shot on the football field that allowed you to escape from Eric Bartlett and company that morning. Of course, she would have further intervened if you had needed her assistance. However, with Ms. Tapshaw, she couldn't take any chances.
Dead? Said Devine. Spears slowly nodded.
Yes. It was either her or you.
She glanced at Campbell.
Can you give us a minute, sir?
Campbell nodded and stepped from the room. Spears pulled her chair even closer and looked deeply at Divine.
So, you were my guardian angel?
He said.
I was supposed to be. When Campbell was thinking of recruiting you, he had me get a room at the townhouse.
Do you sleep with all your...
No, I don't. I made an exception with you.
Her face crinkled into a smile, even as her eyes filled with tears.
I made some mistakes in my earlier career, Travis. I guess you did too. I don't know if you know this, but Campbell collects people like you and me. We're sort of like the misfit toys on that island in Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. Damaged, but capable of...
Redemption, he finished for her.
Yes, redemption.
So you slept with me to show you were my ally? He mumbled.
She stared at him for a long moment, something building in her expression that Divine's drug-induced thoughts could not readily interpret.
I slept with you, Travis, because I wanted to sleep with you.
Why did you search Will's room?
I was suspicious, and there seemed to be things hidden too close to that townhouse. I wanted to find out if we had enemies in our own camp.
She reached down and stroked his cheek, and it felt so good. Divine nodded and closed his eyes as the morphine flowed into him, engaging in a pitched battle with the pain ebbing just below the surface of his punctured shoulder. When he awoke again, he was feeling better, and time apparently had marched on. It had been dark when Campbell and Spears had been there. It was daylight now, and he sensed that multiple days had passed. Nurses walked in and walked out after checking on him. Doctors and specialists examined him constantly. He eyed his vitals on the monitor. They looked closer to normal than he probably deserved. Campbell visited him regularly, and then walked in one morning and sat down next to him.
You look much better today, he said.
Divine managed to inch up a bit on his pillow before hitting the bed control to raise himself up more.
I think I've rounded the corner.
Good.
Jill Tapshaw?
Her mother came to claim her body. We gave her a full briefing. Well, as full as we could.
How did you know what to tell her about Jill? I haven't been able to tell you anything.
She left a full written confession in her room, said Campbell. I think when she went to her office that night, she intended to kill herself using your gun. But she found you there instead. Worse luck for you. If she had killed you, she probably would have turned the gun on herself. Her poor mother was devastated. She's lost both her children.
Jill was a brilliant person. She did a lot to help people, and she could have done a lot more.
She did a lot to hurt people, too, countered Campbell.
What about Cal and Cumley?
Shut down. The people behind Area 51 are still out there, but you disrupted their operations to a considerable extent.
But how much damage have they already done?
We reviewed the report your friend Valentine cobbled together. That was hardly all of it, and we're working on finding out more. From what we can make out, foreign interests who are no friend of the United States own more of this country than most people, myself included, can even comprehend. And a lot of politicians across the country have received dark money from these same groups.
What will happen to them?
Probably nothing. They'll shout to the heavens that they didn't know, or it's all fake, or entrapment, or a political hit job. And they'll keep their positions, and go on doing exactly what they were doing, and sucking on the same dark money teat.
That is some sick shit, Divine said wearily.
But we have to keep this on the QT, Divine.
What? Why?
International relations, key alliances, not wanting to rock the boat too much. Disrupt political arenas and financial markets, that sort of thing.
That is total bullshit.
I agree. It is, Campbell conceded.
Divine looked out the window at the sunny day.
So I didn't really complete my mission then. And you don't give out participation trophies. Am I headed to USDB?
I think you're well on your way to a second chance, Divine, if you want it.
The two former soldiers stared at each other.
I want it, Devine finally said. And that's a good reason to get out of bed every day. Devine looked around the room. Have you heard from Michelle Montgomery? She's left the country. Devine nodded, looking and feeling disappointed. Okay. She didn't really have a choice. Devine glanced back at him. What? She wanted to visit you here many times, but that would not have been a good thing, so I put the kibosh on that. We arranged for a safe place for her to live abroad. Campbell pulled an envelope from his pocket. But she asked me to give you this. Devine took the envelope. Without another word, Campbell left. Devine slowly opened the envelope and slipped a single page and two photos out. He glanced down the paper and began to read.
Dear Travis, what a ride. I've never been more scared and more excited in my life. Not sure what that says about me, but just being honest. I guess the general has told you what happened. I didn't want to leave you, but he didn't give me a choice. I can say I will miss you, and I will. But I'm convinced we will see each other again. And while the general won't like it, you can reach me at this phone number.
Devine eyed the international phone number with the country code for Italy. He read the rest of the letter.
I won't call you because I don't want to put pressure on you, but you can call me. I'm so sorry about what happened to you. I never would have guessed that that sweet-looking girl who founded a dating service to help people find love would have been so screwed up. I hope you recover quickly. Even though I couldn't visit you in the hospital, I was thinking about you all the time. And remember, while we both have baggage, it can't last forever. And even if it does, life must go on. And I don't think you or I need a dating service to find the person just right for us. I'll always love you. Michelle. P.S. The man in that photo is a keeper. The one of me is so you won't forget.
Devine next looked at the photos. The one of him was the same photo she'd taken on the rooftop of her building, the troubled man with baggage. The one of her did not have her in a bikini, but rather jeans and a t-shirt, with the loveliest smile he had ever seen. He reluctantly set her picture aside and stared at the ceiling. He had never suspected Jill Tapshaw. He had trusted her, and then nearly been killed by her. He had not trusted Helen Spears, and she had been the one to save his life. He had suspected Will Valentine of wrongdoing, and the man had done nothing but be his friend and help him. And his payment for that had been the loss of his life. During an earlier visit, Campbell had told him that Valentine's family back in Russia had been taken away by the state. The infant Valentine had been left alone and then whisked out of the country by family friends. But with Michelle Montgomery, in the end, he had trusted her, and that trust had been amply rewarded. So maybe my instincts aren't all bad, but one out of four isn't going to cut it while working for Campbell. He turned to the window and lay there, staring at the rising sun of a new day. Chapter 84. It was 3 weeks later, at precisely 6:20 in the morning. Devine, his arm in a sling, stepped onto the train. He was leaving the area the next day, but he wanted to take one more trip on the 6:20. He wasn't sure why, but then again, maybe he was. The train started to fill, station after station, with the young gladiators in their suits and skirts, their laptops and clouds fired up and gestating future wealth for those with already too much of it. Later, the train climbed the little knoll, slowed, and then stopped, like a thirsty animal does at Creekside for a drink. The Cowell Palace was for sale. There was no Michelle Montgomery in her Morse code bikini, no swaggering billionaire in his natural habitat of unparalleled luxuriousness. Devine looked around the train car and saw all gazes stuck to computer screens. He took out his laptop and looked over the email he had crafted along with a large attachment. It documented everything he had found out about Cowell and Cumley. He hit the send key, and off it flew to one Elaine Nestor, the tarred and feathered journalist. Go and win a Pulitzer, Elaine. And screw the powers that be and the dark money they suck on. Devine found himself staring out the window and conjuring up images that bordered partly on nostalgia and partly on necessity. His need to feel something, to regret things, to sense guilt and loss and other things he couldn't readily identify right now. Figuring out the inexplicable was never easy. Sarah Hughes and Jen Stamos dead. Jill Tapshaw, too. Three remarkable women who could have done a lot of good in the world, given the chance. But Tapshaw hadn't given the other two the opportunity. In her brilliant, twisted mind, they needed to be punished and removed from the living. And Will Valentine, his beer-guzzling friend with more optimism than any person Devine had ever met, and who loved his adopted country more than some native-born citizens, was also dead. But Michelle Montgomery was still alive, though denied a place at whatever table Devine would be heading to, alone. But I have her phone number, and a letter from her in which she says she'll always love me. Right now, that is enough. The train started up again with a jolt. He turned away from the glass and stared straight ahead, the only direction he could now see himself heading. What lay there for him could be bullets or bombs once more, or the more subtle entanglements that happened all over the world outside combat zones. He didn't know which was more dangerous, or whether it would end up being a tie. He only hoped that he was up to the task. Ranger tabbed, and Ranger scrolled, and a seasoned financial analyst to boot. Devine would probably need all of it, and a little bit more to survive, along with luck. A good soldier never discounted the intervention of well-timed luck. Redemption. A second shot. A new lease on life. Maybe this was all of those things. You'll never know until you try, soldier. He sat back, closed his eyes, and let the 6:20 train take him somewhere. One more time. This has been a Hachette audio production of The 6:20 Man, written by David Baldacci, read by Zachary Weber, Mella Lee, and Christine Lakin. Produced and directed by Dennis Kao. Sound editing by Ian Lehman and Sean Bolter. Mixing and mastering by Jeremy Wesley. Production supervised by Lisa Kahn. Recorded at Literati Audio Studios. The 6:20 Man is also available in print and digital formats from Grand Central Publishing, a division of Hachette Book Group. For more Hachette audio productions, visit us at hachetteaudio.com. Thank you for listening. Text copyright 2022 by Columbus Rose Limited. Audio production copyright 2022 Hachette Audio. All rights reserved. Hachette Book Group supports the right to free expression and the value of copyright. The purpose of copyright is to encourage writers and artists to produce the creative works that enrich our culture. The duplicating, uploading, and distribution of this book without permission is a theft of the author's intellectual property. If you would like permission to use material from the book, other than for review purposes, please contact permissions at hbgusa.com. Thank you for your support of the author's rights. This audiobook is a work of fiction. Names, characters, places, and incidents are either the product of the author's imagination or are used fictitiously, and any resemblance to actual persons, living or dead, events, or locales is entirely coincidental.